Welcome to Soul Talk, soulful conversations exploring who you are, why you're here, and how to live your most authentic life. My name is Coop Blackson, nationally bestselling author of You Are the One, transformational teacher, and your host. I invite you to subscribe to the Soul Talk podcast for weekly inspiration from me, where I will share with you some powerful ideas, thoughts, and practical life wisdom to help you live life more fully, freeing yourself from your past, reclaiming your power, and living your true life's purpose. You can also go to www.coopblackson.com, enter your name and email to download my free 2-part video training series and learn the ultimate secrets to happiness and fulfillment. Let's get started with Soul Talk. Welcome, folks. Welcome to another very special episode of the Soul Talk podcast. I'm really thrilled about today's episode. I've been looking forward to hanging on Soul Talk with someone who I consider a dear soul friend. She's regarded as, she's been on Soul Talk before, so we're going to put her previous episode so you can dive deep into, you know, her roots and her story, which we did in that episode. So we'll put those links in the show notes. But she's regarded as a leading expert in meditation for high performance. She is the creator of the Ziva technique and founder of Ziva, where she developed the world, one of the world's top meditation training programs. Welcome, my dear friend, Emily Fletcher.
Hi, I have been looking forward to this day to reconnect.
Right. It's been on my radar.
I'm glad feel like we've lived many lifetimes since our last conversation.
Yeah, and I was just telling Emily that since the last time I saw her, or the last interview, whichever, she is glowing. Like if you could see her now, she is just radiant and glowing. So she is doing something right. And I'm looking forward to just finding out what you've been up to, what you've been doing. And so you've been, what's this? You said new body of work. You've been exploring and creating a new body of work. I'm always curious as a teacher in terms of the creativity of creating a new body of work. Can you just share a bit about the new body of work? I want to dive into that.
Yeah. So it's called Sacred Secret, and it's an embodied manifesting modality. You know, so many of us have, you know, grown up on the secret or know about manifesting. And I've been teaching manifesting for 6 or 7 years, but to be honest, I was doing it from the neck up, and it still works. You know, thoughts become things. What we put our attention on grows. But what I have found in the past couple of years through my own personal experience, and now having, you know, researched and developed on retreats and working with humans, is that if we can get our bodies in on the game, if we can actually embody the manifestation, not only does it accelerate the process, but it amplifies your life force. So the reason why I am glowing right now is that I am tapping into some really potent internal chemistry. You know, we're in this day and age where we're in the middle of this, certainly this psychedelic revolution. And I think that we're just on the cusp of a different kind of revolution where we can tap into our own endogenous pharmacology and not necessarily have to use exogenous pharmacology. It's like nature's already installed all of this stuff inside of us.
Yeah, we are the medicine.
Unfortunately, like we've been shamed and blamed and conditioned to think that it is bad or wrong or a sin. And it's been a very effective campaign for tens of thousands of years to divorce us, not only from our own divinity, but from our own desire. And so for me, over the past 3 years, this has been a reclamation of my own body, a reclamation of my own bliss chemistry, and a reclamation of my own pleasure. I didn't even like that word, pleasure. And now I would say that I am using my pleasure to pray. And so
what do you mean using your pleasure to pray? We can't skip over that one.
Yeah. If I had to make the world's simplest manifestation formula, it would be this: feel good, place the order, place the order, feel good. Feel good, place the order, place the order, feel good. Feel good, place the order, feel good. And yes, it's a silly little song and it's a simple, simple formula to understand, but it's not so simple to practice. Because when I say feel good, I don't mean spiritually bypass. I don't mean put a happy face sticker on top of a gaping wound. I mean doing whatever it takes to sustainably, reliably feel good. And for a lot of us, that means starting with therapy or trauma therapy or cleaning up your lies or getting your buns to the meditation cushion or getting your buns to the gym, like whatever you need to do to start to vibrate and radiate at a sustainable place of what I would call bliss. And bliss is not synonymous with happiness. Okay. Happiness is just one key on the keyboard. Bliss is the background behind all 88 keys, like the entirety of the human experience. The ability to feel your agony and your ecstasy inside of 1 hour, I think, is a uniquely human experience. So feel good isn't just like, I'm fine. Yeah, it's not happy, right? It's trusting that deeper bliss that is going to make you feel safe enough to go into your rage, into your agony, into your sorrow. So I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So that's the feel good part, which is whatever it takes, right? And then place the order is getting brave enough for you to claim your desires, right? Like actually placing your order with the cosmic server at the cosmic restaurant. And where I think people trip themselves up here is, and I don't know, you probably hear this in your work as well. Emily, I don't know what I want. Emily, I know that manifesting works, but I don't know what I want. And I think that this is a byproduct of us divorcing ourselves from our own physical desire, of thinking that somehow our physical desire is a sin or bad, or that we're not supposed to want things, which is actually a very monastic way of looking at life, right? Like if you're a monk.
Can you speak about that in terms of like, we're often taught in spirituality, desire is the root of all evil. Desire is bad. Desire is ego, right? You have to transcend all desire. You see these yogis meditating like no desire. And so what if someone's like, yeah, but Emily, like, I want a Ferrari. I want a Rolls Royce. I want a freaking private jet. I want to. And how does that fit into the spiritual path? And is this desire correct? Or is it just for my ego? Is it for my wounding? It's like, is all desire good? About that.
Yeah, these are great, great questions. And where I think we've gotten confused and where I think we've honestly done ourselves a huge disservice is that I feel like we've had a game of telephone. And we took practices and teachings that were made for monks, that were designed to be monastic practices, and we have mistranslated them for the rest of us. We have taken monastic meditation practices and we've watered them down and put them on apps and said like, hey, everybody, this is meditation. And now we have a whole population of people who are trying to clear their minds, who feel frustrated that they can't, who think that meditation is hard. And it breaks my heart because we now have potentially robbed ourselves of a lifetime of bliss and fulfillment and accelerated manifestation because we're judging ourselves based on misinformation. We think that the point is to clear our mind. And I would argue that the point of meditation is to get good at life. Now, here's where the telephone game came in. It's less than 1% of the world's population that is monastic by nature. That means that by nature, they don't want to have sex. By nature, they are reclusive. By nature, they don't want to have a job. And so they have a different contribution to society. They're meditating all day. They are purifying the collective consciousness by raising their state. And that is how they're contributing. For those of us who want to have kids and who want to have partners and who like having sex and who want to be a part of society, we are called householders. Okay, that's what you call them in India. 99% of the population, we are householders. And the meditation portion of Ziva is based on a householder technique. It's something called Nishkam Karma Yoga, or union attained by action hardly taken, lazy meditation. And it's quote unquote lazy because you're using a tool that's giving your body rest that's 5 times deeper than sleep. So it's very easy. You're giving your body deep healing rest and you're flooding your brain and body with dopamine and serotonin, which are bliss chemicals, which I would argue brings us back to the feel good, place the order, right? Like I won't even touch manifestation before I meditate. I don't want to think about my desires from a place of stress. I don't want to pray from a place of neediness or lack. I want to fill myself up sustainably with my own internal bliss chemistry. I want to feel so good. I want to feel so fulfilled. And then from that place, we listen. Hey, nature, how would you like to use me? And that, I think, answers your real question of that. If you are manifesting, if you are praying from the place of fulfillment, from that place of connection to source, then I think you can trust those desires. Yeah, it's the delineation between what I would call an intuitive desire and an addictive longing. And either way, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to judge the desire. I don't care if you want a Ferrari. What I care is where that desire came from. Right. If it's that still small voice inside that's like, get that Ferrari,
So, can desire come from that still small voice inside of like, get the Ferrari? Would the still small voice say, get the Ferrari, get the jet, be a billionaire? Would that be a desire that arose from that place? And if so, why? Because I know there's people listening that like, they have these desires, they want to create and achieve and, you know, manifest and have stuff. So,
Yeah. So I think we got to look at the other side of the coin of the, so there's the intuitive desire. And again, I'm not going to judge the content of what that desire is. If it's truly coming from source, it's not my place to judge my own or someone else's desire. But where we want to apply mastery and be really honest with ourselves as to whether or not that is an addictive longing. And an addictive longing is trying to fill an internal hole from an external source, right? That you don't feel like you're good enough. And so you need more followers on Instagram. You don't feel like you're worthy enough. And so you need the fancy car to attract the girls. Mm-hmm. You don't feel like you are happy enough. And so you need to fill your, you know, you need to drink alcohol or take substances to change how you're feeling. Mm-hmm. And anytime you're trying to fill an internal hole with an external source, that's an addictive longing. And that doesn't work. And I think that's why we judge the Ferrari and the $1 billion. And mm-hmm. because it usually, not always, mm-hmm. but usually that extreme kind of desire is coming from a place of lack, right? It's like trying to prove something versus just going to therapy or feeling the feelings. Mm-hmm. And I think also even you could argue that $1 billion, there's a sense of hoarding there. Like, does any one human need $1 billion dollars, or would 900 million do just fine? And then you donate the other 100 million, mm-hmm. you know? So again, this requires nuance. Mm-hmm. I also know a lot of billionaires who are doing an extraordinary amount of good on the planet, and they are moving this energy in a way that is creating mm-hmm. regenerative economy, creating regenerative culture, we're creating generative soil. So again, it's not mine to judge someone else's desire, but I think that we've done ourselves a disservice to adopt a monastic way of thinking if you are not a monk. I think it's messing us up in our meditation practice. And I also think it's messing us up in our manifestations, especially for women. It goes for all genders, but because women have been slut shamed for so long, because we have been told that our desires are not as important as men's, because we've been told that we're not even supposed to have the desires, that we forget how to listen to them. We're so good at fulfilling our children's needs and our partner's needs and our boss's needs and society's needs and looking how everyone else wants us to look. We're so good at being wanted that we forget to tune into our own want. And this goes for all genders, but I see it really loud in people who identify as female.
So someone's listening and they're like, okay, Emily, I don't feel good. You're telling me to feel good. I don't feel good because I look at my life and my life isn't what I want it to be. I don't seem to like my career is not working. My relationship, I don't have a relationship, but shit's falling apart. And just internally, I'm so far from where I want to be. I just don't feel great. And what's a step that they can take? Where can they start to begin activating this internal sort of feeling of goodness and blissness, right?
Yeah. So I know that every hammer finds a nail, mm-hmm. and I am a meditation teacher. So I'm going to say for most people, a great place to start is meditation. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. It's not about, I feel bad in my life, so let me meditate to stop thinking. Let me meditate to escape those bad feelings that I'm having. It's just the opposite. I find that meditation, and especially Ziva, is going to wring you out. It is more of a catharsis tool than it is a numbing tool. And so what the meditation does is that it's going to flood your brain again with dopamine and serotonin, which are bliss chemicals, which is going to allow your body to feel safe enough to actually let go and to express that sorrow, express that rage. Like, a lot of my time that I spend teaching is helping people through the emotional and physical detox that happens in the first few weeks, which not that many people are talking about. Yeah. That, like, if you have 30 years of sorrow and depression and stress, then it makes sense that once your body feels safe, it's going to purge that. It's like, my analogy is, imagine you had like an 8-year-old child. Like, imagine when your son is 8, right? And he goes to school and there's a bully, and the bully punches him and takes his lunch money. And it's like, don't you cry. Don't you cry. Cause if you cry, I'm going to do it again tomorrow. And he's 8. So he can suck it up. You know, he can like pretend like he's okay. He can make it through the school day. And then he comes home and he sees your face and he feels safe with you. And he collapses into your arms and he starts crying. And it's easy to think like, oh, what's wrong? Did I do something wrong? Is he sad because he saw me? It's like, no, he feels safe enough with you to let go of that fear, of that sorrow, of that hurt that he experienced with the bully. And I find that so many of us have been dealing with so much hurt, so much sorrow, so much rage that we have not, one, had the permission to feel. And two, we haven't felt safe enough or been able to regulate our nervous systems enough to actually purge it. And so meditation is going to do both for you. It is going to make the feeling non-negotiable, and it's going to allow your body to feel safe enough to actually feel your feelings. And so that's why I think it's a beautiful step one. And then over time, once you release that backlog of stresses, then you start to build up your bank account. Then it's like you get addicted to the dopamine and serotonin, just like you do anything else. Like just like you take cocaine every day, you're going to need more cocaine. Well, the same is true of bliss chemistry. The amount of dopamine and serotonin you produce on your first day of meditation is not going to do the trick 5 years later. You actually need more of it. So your body starts internally and organically producing more bliss chemistry. Now, why this is not an addiction is because you're filling an internal need with an internal solution. So it's sustainable, it's regenerative. And the benefits of this are cumulative. Like the longer you meditate, the better you're going to feel. And this is all setting you up, I think, for a beautiful manifestation practice, because then you're manifesting from a place of wholeness. Yes. You already know that you're enough. You already know that you are God pretending to be human. And yet we still have the desire. And so this is where it gets exciting. Then the desire becomes an indicator of where nature wants to use you to deliver your fulfillment, not where you need to go to fill yourself up. It's not the all be happy when syndrome. It's now nature's GPS. Nature is cueing you as to like, hey, go here. Yeah, get that Ferrari. Not because the Ferrari is going to make you happy, but because you might meet your future spouse at the dealership, or you might run into someone on the way who needs your support.
It's kind of like almost like a cosmic carrot that moves you in a direction, right?
I love that, the cosmic carrot. It's not even about the dream. Right? Like I moved to LA. I had been on Broadway for 10 years. I moved to LA because I wanted to pursue TV and film. Like I was like, I did it. I had a great run on Broadway. Let me mix it up. Let me try a new industry. And my second day there, I met a meditation teacher who I had connected with in India. I had recently learned to meditate. I had a very beautiful spiritual experience where I was like, oh, I will teach this. But I just thought it would be later, when I'm done dancing, when I'm done acting, I'll do it later. But then on my second day in LA, thinking the carrot, the cosmic carrot was like, go do TV and film. My second day there, I met this amazing teacher and he ended up training me to teach. And so it was like that desire had nothing to do with me becoming a television and film actress. It had everything to do with getting me to LA so I could meet that teacher.
Beautiful. Now, if someone's like, okay, I have these dreams. I feel that they're authentic. I feel it, Emily. You know, a book, a vision, a TV show. Particular objective, but it doesn't happen. It hasn't happened. It's been years. No matter how much I try, I'm meditating. I'm doing the bliss practices. The shit hasn't happened yet. What the hell? And so can you speak to that person who might be wondering, am I doing something wrong? Like what have you found blocks meditation, basically?
Yes.
Blocks manifestation. So
yes, great question. So there's a couple of things. One, disappointment is the price of admission. Like you want to manifest the life of your dreams. Like, okay, get ready. God is not a short order cook. So it's not like I want the house and the boyfriend and the baby and the $1 million by the time I'm 24. It doesn't work like that. Okay. Again, the desires are not there for the acquisition of them. The point of them is not the acquisition of them. It's whoever you are meant to be on the way to them. It's whatever happens on the way. And I'll share a story is that I was manifesting my face off. My book came out, Stress Less, Accomplish More. I have been working on it for 18 months. I was breastfeeding my way through the book launch.
Every day
I was manifesting. I was seeing it on print. I was moving my feet, right? Like I say, you know, we pray and move our feet. I was doing both. I was manifesting. I was taking action and we sold a lot of books. Like if the New York Times had just gone by book sales, we would have been number 5.
Wow.
So like we did it, you know, and yet the New York Times didn't choose me. They didn't put me on the list for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And I was devastated. Like I was crushed. So it's like, I did everything quote unquote, right. I was following my own recipe. And then there was two things that I learned out of that. One, it was when I called my coach, like crying, devastated. She said, Emily, you're making it about you. I was like, what? So you're making this about you. And I said, well, I don't understand. She's like, yeah, the only reason you care about the New York Times is because you're sad about your goal. She's like, your book just sold tens of thousands of copies. All of those people are now ingesting your message. This is going to grow the mission and you're sad about it? Like, that's your ego. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like, by all measures, this thing was a raging success. But because I was attached to becoming a New York Times bestseller, because I thought that would be the thing, I was disappointed. And in hindsight, like, I've gotten more juice out of that story, out of being able to share what I learned from that quote unquote failure, than I think I ever would from being a New York Times bestseller. So that's one piece. The other piece is that if it's like, it's also possible that the desire might have changed. You know, I think sometimes we white knuckle our desires and we think that, well, because I told myself when I was 12 that I was going to win an Oscar award, that now I'm 47 and I still haven't won an Oscar award. Yeah. It's like, we got to check in and be like, is that truly still the desire now? Or has the desire changed? And so again, I think that meditation is a great precursor for this, because it's not going to allow you to like white knuckle the desires. So sometimes simply opening up your hand and giving thanks for what is, like enthusiastic gratitude for what is going to do a few things. One, it's going to prove to you what a powerful manifest you already are, how much you've already co-created with nature. Two, it's going to allow nature to feel reciprocated. Like if you got a friend that was asking you for things all the time and you never said thank you, you might stop giving them things.
How about F you?
Yeah. How about you do something for me? How about a thank you note? Right?
Could be a book. The universe is saying F you, you know?
I hope that's your next book title. Yeah. But I also think that gratitude is going to open up the death grip of desire. It's going to allow you to hear if there's any new desires that are even more charming that are bubbling up.
Beautiful. Gratitude. Such a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I asked you this last time, but it just popped up as you were sharing. How much of our life do you feel we actually, how much of our destiny, our life, do you feel we have control over? Or, you know, because some people say, well, yeah, this manifestation thing is great, but this is just my karma in life, Emily, to just have these kinds of relationships. You know, it's just my karma to have this health issue. It's my karma in this life to have financial struggles, and there's lessons there, and I'm at peace with that. And so it's just my karma. So I guess how much of our life is our karma that is what it is, and how much can we shift, right? How much can we transcend that? Can we transcend that? Can anyone become like Jeff Bezos or, you know, President of the United States if they just go into that manifestation mode? Or is it just like just fucking Donald Trump's karma? It's just his karma that he, you know, despite what he does, he was just going to be president, you know? And so
great
karma,
question.
Destiny, what your thoughts are there?
Yeah. So the answer is I don't know. I don't think any of us know. And the paradigm that I enjoy, that feels good to me to adopt, is 50-50. And the reason why I have that theory is that I look at the human brain. If you look at the human brain, it's actually, it's two separate instruments. The left brain and the right brain are not attached, except for a tiny little piece called the corpus callosum. Right now, just the cliff notes on the corpus callosum is that the longer you meditate, the thicker the corpus callosum becomes, which is the bridge between the right and left brain. But the way I think about right and left brain and how it attunes to karma is that your left brain is individuality and the right brain is totality. And so that's why I think it's 50-50, that we have to do 50% of our work. We have to clean up our lives. We have to clean up the places where we're out of integrity. We have to go into that trauma. And I think in the ways that I heard you quoting people of like, this is just my karma, what I was hearing is this is just my trauma. Like I just came from a lineage of alcoholics. And so I'm just going to be an alcoholic. And it's like, no, that's your epigenetics. And so just to go into the science of this a bit, epigenetics are 95% of your genetic blueprint. It's only 5% of your genes that are fixed. So I got to hear the man who was like very key in decoding the human genome speak a long time ago. And the way that he described it was so beautiful. He said, if you imagine that the human genome is 100-page book, the first 95 pages are your epigenetics, which are mutable. Those are changeable. You can turn them on and off. Wow. It's only the last 5 pages that are fixed.
Wow.
And so to say that something is quote unquote my karma or something is just like, this is just my family, this is just my lineage, I don't think that's true. I think that we're all given a blueprint. And I think that blueprint really matters. Mm. And if you don't do anything about it, then the house will just get built according to the blueprint. Mm. But if every single day you're in there talking to the architects, talking to the construction crew, so, no, I want this house here. No, I want this wall here. I want this whole wall to be windows. And you're in there doing the work. I think that you can change it. And I think that every time we meditate, every time we get sunshine in our eyes, every time we make love with consciousness and presence, every time we eat nourishing food from the earth, every time we are of service, every time we give thanks, that is turning on your healthy gene expressions. Mm-hmm. And conversely, every time we don't, it's turning on the unhealthy gene expressions. Mm-hmm. And the tricky part, and this is maybe where the math gets skewed and it's not quite 50-50, is that we're swimming in a very toxic environment, right? Like we're living in a world where our food is not food. We don't have sunshine. We just have blue computer lights in our eyes all the time. The soil is depleted. We've got, you know, the rays from the cell phone on us. We've got, you know, people who are very stressed impacting our field. And so while, yes, I believe that it's a 50-50 game, that it's 50% individuality and 50% totality when it comes to manifestation, where it sometimes might feel like an uphill battle, is the soup that we're swimming in, the racism that we're swimming in, the misogyny that we're swimming in, the toxic environment that we're swimming in. So it's like, in order for your individuality to have the deck stacked in your favor, it's like, we all have to become quote unquote biohackers. We all have to become spirit hackers, because if you just leave it to the communal devices, we're not really set up for success.
Got it. I like that. It triggered a question as you were speaking. Like, you look at, you know, these enlightened people, right? Ramana Maharishi, Yogananda, some of these people, and some of these enlightened masters, you know, died of Nisargadatta Maharaj, you know, they died of, you know, cancer, or they got a disease. And I'm curious, like, why do enlightened people get sick?
Yeah, what a great question.
You know, why? I'm just curious on your thoughts. Like, if someone is truly awakened to that level, like, why do they get sick then? Like, are there any thoughts on that? Shouldn't they just transcend all dimensions of the sort of three-dimensional duality and just self-heal at any moment?
Well, I think where this gets tricky is that we want to deify humans. Mm. And just because a human has reached a state of enlightenment doesn't mean that they're deities. It doesn't mean that they're gods. They're still human. And I think that we get in trouble when we start to sanctify or deify spiritual teachers, because one, we take our power away from ourselves and give it to them. I think that's why we've seen the fall of so many gurus as of late, because we're moving out of the age of guru. And it's like, we really need to learn that we're all God pretending to be human, that truly, like, I have as much access to spirit as you do, as anyone listening to this podcast. Like I used to say the term, the democratization of God. And I was like, no, God's already democratized. You don't need to democratize God. It's already democratized. It's just, are we turning up the dial on our own divinity? And so, as far as, I'd have to look at it case by case on each of those humans, but it could be that that was their final lesson. It could be that maybe their teachings had become, maybe they had served all that they needed to serve and they weren't relevant on this plane anymore. Maybe their spirit was more useful not on the physical plane. So I'd have to take it case by case. But I think that inherent in the question is a belief that somehow death is bad, or that it's something to be transcended, or that sickness even is bad and something to be transcended. And so what if instead we were to embrace sickness or embrace death with the same passion that I am suggesting that people embrace their sorrow or their rage? Because we've been taught to not feel our feelings, and that anything that is not light is bad, because we've been living in this dualistic, good, bad, right, wrong sort of monotheistic culture. Mm-hmm. It's easy to judge the rage and the sorrow and the fear and the sickness as quote unquote bad, which what if instead it was seen as just one of the notes on the keyboard, one of the lessons for me to learn, one of the experiences that I could have as a human. And then I bring my enlightenment to that. Mm. I bring that awareness that I am not just this body to the sickness. I bring the awareness that I am not just my sadness into the sorrow, so that you're able to experience the simultaneity. And this has helped me with this, is that, I don't know where you sit on the non-human species tip or on the alien tip these days, but, you know, we're entering an interesting age where, like, members of Congress and Army and Navy generals are testifying in front of Congress about biologics and machinery that the government has had for, you know, decades. Wow. So it's an interesting time, but it's been communicated to me that non-humans are very covetous of the human experience because it is very unique to be able to experience all 88 keys, to have agony and ecstasy inside of the same hour. Is like a coveted frequency because there might be whole galaxies, whole universes that are just vibrating at a similar frequency, just sorrow, just ecstasy, just light, just dark. And so the fact that we get to swim in all of it, what if we were to see that as a gift rather than something to transcend?
Mm, I love it. It's like, imagine if you could only eat only one flavor ice cream for the rest of your life. How boring that would. Even if it was an amazing flavor, it's like, shit, cookies and cream again, 50 years later. Like, I love it, but now I hate it, you know?
Yeah, that is my favorite ice cream flavor, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Cookies and cream.
Great, great souls think alike. So back to sort of these bliss practices, right, for embodied manifestation. Okay, meditation. Connect to meditation. Now, what else? What else? What else do you do in terms of bliss practices to sort of access the body and wake the body up to this pleasure and joy?
Yeah. So this is the Sacred Secret formula. So I'd say at its biggest, Sacred Secret is a movement. It is a movement helping people to remember just how creative and just how powerful they are. At its simplest, Sacred Secret is a formula. And here's the formula. We visualize, alchemize, magnetize. So visualize, alchemize, magnetize. And the visualization, this is what most people are probably very familiar with. This is what we do at the end of our Ziva practice, from that place of source, from that place of feeling good, from that place of connection and de-excitation of the nervous system. I invite people to ask, like, what would I love? What would I love right now? And there's some keys inside of that question. What would I love puts you into spirit. It puts you into possibility. Not what do I need? Not what do I want? Not what's going to look good on my resume? Not what does my mom want? But what would I love? Mm. And then what would I love right now puts you into presence, present moment. What's the desire now? Not when I was 12. Not what I promised myself I would do when I started my career. But what would I love right now? And then from that place, I let people swim and marinate in that for a while, like really feeling it, feeling all five senses of this visualization, dropping themselves into the VR headset of the dream already happened. And then from there, we alchemize. Mm. What does that mean? It means that likely there's something standing in the way of that dream manifesting. Otherwise, it would be here already. Right? Mm-hmm. Like either you need to learn something, be something, integrate something, or feel something in order for you to be an energetic match for this manifestation. Mm-hmm. And so the alchemy process is basically I have people go into what is the limiting belief? What is the trauma? What is the fear? What is the story? And then we usually there's like a piece of them that's protecting themselves from the dream, just like in internal family systems or our parts work. There's like a protector part. And sometimes that protector part won't even let you hear the desire. Right? I'm good. I don't need anything. This is just my karma. I'm just not even going to want anything. But that's a protector. That's a defense mechanism. Right. So once we get past that and we're actually willing to see the dream, then usually there's something that's like, oh, I'm too old. I'm too black. I'm too white. I'm too female. I'm too male. I'm too gay. I'm too whatever. Or my dad told me I wasn't smart enough, or I tried it and I failed. So we just go in and we actually feel the unfelt feelings around it. And when we do our retreats, like things get wild. So this process is called emotional alchemy. And I use music as the catalyst. It's very much like somatic expression, somatic dance. And we go into that sacred rage, that sacred warrior, and we let it take the microphone. We let it be heard. We let it be loud. We let it be expressed. And then usually that protector part is protecting something a little bit more vulnerable, a little bit more scared, a little bit younger part of you, a little bit more innocent part of you that's devastated that this thing has not shown up or terrified that it might never show up. And then we give that part the microphone and we let that fear and that sorrow be expressed again through movement, through song, through whatever, and whatever wants to come up and out. And this is where this practice just keeps blowing my mind again and again, is that there is... If you let the feeling be fully felt, we can get to a place of ecstasy where you find ecstasy in the expression of the rage, ecstasy in the expression of the sorrow. And then that ecstasy becomes the alchemical force. That pleasure that you find in the expression of the emotion starts to alchemize it, and it starts to turn the lead into gold. It starts to turn the fear into fuel for your dreams, and it also clears the channel, right? So then from that place of visualization and alchemization, then we go into magnetization, right? And so what does magnetize mean? It means we turn on the magnet of your body. We turn on the generator of your body, and that happens to be your hoo-ha. So here's the good news about a hoo-ha. Everybody has one. All genders, right? All genders. And it's not just the anatomy. It's the energy center around it. So just like when someone says, tune into your heart, it's not just about the muscle. It's about the electromagnetic field around it. And interestingly, I'm sure you know this, the electromagnetic field of your heart is 5,000 times more powerful than that of your head. So now imagine we could get our heads, our hearts, and our hoo-has all in coherence with each other, all pointed towards our dream. This is where the magic starts to happen. And what you're doing is that, I mean, talk about feeling good and placing the order, right? It's like now, in addition to dopamine and serotonin, which is what is released when you meditate, if we start to tune into what I call creation energy, which is the most creative force on the planet, and it has the power to, yes, create a baby. It could also create a company or a book or a movement. It's just pure potential. It's just pure energy. And when you start to tap into it, and then pull it up into your vision, it can supercharge your manifestations. It can
You're talking about this, what some would call sexual energy.
Exactly. Just, sexual
energy. For those listening in, so they can just.
So I call creation, I call sexual energy creation energy.
Creation energy,
Just because that word sexual has so much baggage, so much shame, so much weight. And when people hear it, they can contract. And so, yes, that is what we're talking about, but it's possible to tap into sexual energy without sexualizing yourself, without sexualizing someone else. But actually, you're making love to your dream. You're making love to your soul. You're connecting with it, with your head, your heart, and your body. So that when the opportunity for that dream comes, it one, feels safe in your nervous system. Two, you believe that you deserve it. And three, it's like reacquainting with an old lover versus like, oh my gosh, this is the opportunity that's going to make or break my whole career. And we get stressed and we get tense and we get into I'll be happy when. If you've practiced visiting your dream from a place of full pleasure, full openness, full flooding of this bliss chemistry in your body, when the opportunity comes, it's going to feel so safe, so easy. And it's like you're actually magnetizing it to you. You're bending reality, because the other piece, not for nothing, when you're in these very heightened ecstatic states, you are changing your state of consciousness. You are transcending time because you're transcending thought. So our new mission at Ziva is to help people turn up the dial on their divinity through meditation, pleasure, and medicine, so that we can solve the big challenges that we're facing as a species and have a great time doing it. Now, why meditation, pleasure, and medicine? Well, actually, what those three things have in common is that they're all allowing you to practice dying. Like in meditation, there are moments where you're not, right? You're not Coot anymore. I'm not Emily. You just are. Same can happen in medicine ceremonies. You're connected with the everythingness. And the same thing happens in orgasm. So in French, the word for orgasm is le petit mort,
little death,
right? So we're practicing dying in these ways that are going to allow you to transcend your individuality, connect to totality, so that it's like you're able to dance with the divine. You're able to shift timelines. You're able to start to magnetize this dream to you.
So what are you saying exactly when it comes to tapping into this creation energy? Are you talking about masturbating? Are you talking about incorporating that? Or like, can you be more specific? Because I know some people are going to be like, okay, well, what is she saying exactly? How do I tap into that? What does she mean? And so,
So great question. So the cool thing about Sacred Secret is that you can calibrate it. Like I just gave a talk this weekend at Gaia, and it was, you know, streamed to tens of thousands of people. And so certainly I was not leading tens of thousands of people in a self-pleasuring practice on a stage with fluorescent lights. So the cool thing is you can do this in a rated G way. You can do it in a rated PG way. You can do it in an NC-17 way or all the way to R. And so I've done this with simply breath. I've done Sacred Secret with play. Like I once spoke to a group of like Fortune 100 CEOs and CMOs. And what I did for them is because I knew that it was such a corporate environment that they didn't even really want to get anywhere near sexual energy. So instead I got it so innocent, so playful, so childlike that I brought out like 14 giant giant paper bowls. And I had everyone drop into meditation. I had them picture their goal for their company. Like, what's your quarterly goal for your company this year? Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, hold that dream. And I put on some like jock jams. I put on some music and the whole room started playing. And I said, okay, the rules are no one can let the balls touch the ground. And for 1 minute, they just started playing and like immediately so much bliss chemistry flowing through their bodies. Yeah, and I said, okay, now let the balls drop, sit down. And I said, close your eyes and think about that dream. And I said, who here feels like their dream is more possible right now? And 100% of the people raised their hand. So it's possible to do sacred secret. You can visualize, alchemize, and magnetize without even really touching quote unquote like sexual energy.
However,
on our retreats, like when we have people who are consenting, where there is an extraordinary amount of safety, where people are warmed up and ready and they've been through the full emotional alchemy process. Yes, we do go into a full self-pleasuring practice. Lights are low, people are clothed, people are in their own space, but they are moving themselves into these very heightened states where they get to dance with their dreams, where they're basically making love to their dreams. And what 100% of them say is that their dreams feel more possible on the other side, that they're able to feel that dream as if it is their reality, like they never have before. And then the amount of manifestations that happen feel like magic. Now, the other cool thing that happens is that you can practice this on your own. You can practice this with a partner. And when we do it in groups, it's like the collective antenna gets bigger. It's like the coherence of the people amplifies the manifestation.
Beautiful. Yeah, I see why you call it creative energy, because it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be connected to a sexual thing. It's just the creative life force energy and tapping into that in different ways,
which
is really, really beautiful. Yeah.
And like, and you said, to bring it back to the very beginning of like, why am I glowing? I think it's because now I am actively tapping into that life force energy, to that pure creation energy. I'm making a practice out of it. And I have a sort of embarrassing admission, is that I did not prioritize my pleasure. I did not tap into this energy on a regular basis until I understood that it could supercharge my manifestations. Until I understood that I could use this life force to fuel my dreams, I didn't make time for it. And I think that so many people are the same, because we've been so shamed, so conditioned to think that it is bad or wrong or unholy or dirty, or it's going to take us away from the divine. It wasn't until I understood that ecstasy for tens of thousands of years was seen as a purifying force, that actually it could bring you closer to the divine and that it can supercharge your manifestations, that I started to make time in my day to prioritize it like I would exercise or like I would meditation. And it has made everything better.
You know, there's temples in India where women would dance in ecstasy, you know, glorifying, praising the divine, right? And bringing everyone into that state of bliss.
I'm very interested in this. So like the temple arts and priestesses. Yeah. I mean, in India, there's a temple in Khajuraho,
which is dedicated to that. So you should.
You have like the sculptures outside with these different erotic acts. And it's like, wait, what do you mean? A church, a temple with erotic acts? We've been so taught to think that that is bad. And sexual energy is only really given a voice in Western culture in the dark side, like porn and rape and misogyny. And like all of the dark is being represented almost everywhere. I said the other day to my friend, I said, it's as if we were only having a conversation about food that was talking about junk food and candy. That the only thing we ever said about food is that it would poison you. And no one said that, like, hey, broccoli's really good for you. Hey, cauliflower is great. Hey, blueberries can help your brain. It's like food is medicine and it can be poison. And the same is true of sexual energy. It is one of the most potent medicinal forces that we have as a species. And of course it can be poison, but what matters is the intention. What matters is the set and setting. So I'm very interested in temple arts. I'm very interested in a revival of these ancient practices that we used to know. We used to bring people in orgasmic states to birth their babies. We used to bring people in orgasmic states to transition into death.
Yes.
Bring people into orgasmic states to pray. And so this summer I went on a priestess pilgrimage with my best friend, Layla Martin, and we went to Greece and we went to Eleusis, Delphi, and Crete, which were all sites where there were priestesses practicing temple arts and serving sacrament, serving the precursor to LSD, which is ergot, serving mushroom mixtures. So basically giving people these visceral experiences, these visceral pathways of their own divinity through psychedelics and through fertility rituals. And what's interesting specifically about Eleusis is that it is 45 minutes outside of Athens.
Wow.
And these rituals, specifically known as the Eleusinian Mysteries, were happening for 3,000 years at the height of the Greco-Roman Empire, at the height of Greece, where so like the emperors, the generals, the Plato, Euripides, Aristotle, like these people that shaped Western civilization as we know it, were actually going to experience these rituals in Eleusis and then birthing much of what we know as Western civilization out of it. So wow. Things like democracy, theater were born out of these rituals. Now where the sort of sad irony comes is that this is the same thing that then turned into the patriarchal world order that we know that then robbed so many of the indigenous cultures of these same practices.
Beautiful. You know, what are your thoughts on psychedelics? Is it necessary in our culture? Do we need it? Can we not just go straight to the medicine that's inside of us? I'm curious to hear your thoughts because it's become a popularized thing in our culture today.
Yeah.
And I see many people I see some people doing a psychedelic ceremony every weekend, you know?
Yeah.
And so my concern is the relationship with, you know, plant medicine and psychedelics. If we're not discerning, I think can become in and of itself a crutch or an addiction as well. So I'm just curious about your thoughts, you know?
Yeah, I think that's so well said. And I think that, you know, just like food can be medicine or poison, just like sexuality can be medicine or poison, I think the same is true even of plant medicine. And if you're doing ayahuasca every weekend, if you're doing ketamine every day, if you're doing anything as a form of escapism, anything to take you out of this human life, that I would call an addictive longing, right? Like you're trying to go away to solve the life problem versus to me, the beauty of psychedelics is that it gives you this window into an elevated state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It gives you a window into what is possible, but it does not alleviate or absolve us from the work that we then need to do to build those steps, to build that bridge to those heightened states of consciousness. So I personally have been working with psychedelics for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. They've been a huge part of my path, a huge part of my growth. I owe a huge debt of gratitude to these different medicines. And I also have a meditation practice. I've also been meditating every day, twice a day for 16 years. Mm. And the meditation to me can help alleviate a lot of that because it's one, going to allow you to listen leading up to the ceremony. What do I really want to get out of this? Mm. And two, it's going to help you to integrate whatever downloads, whatever insights, whatever expanded state of consciousness came from the medicine. Doesn't really do any good if you don't integrate it back into your 3D reality. And I would say the same thing about meditation. I don't care if you're talking to God while your eyes are closed. I don't care how many or few thoughts you're having in the chair if you're an asshole to your children. I don't care what's happening with your eyes closed if you're not being kind to your coworkers. So always it's about getting good at life. And if we forget that, regardless of the modality, then I think we've misstepped. But I think that, you know, set and setting intention, reverence to the substances, reverence to the spirit of the medicine that you're working with, I think that there's so much good that can come out of it. Because if Joe Blow, let's just say like your average Western, like your average Western white dude who's like never done tantra, never really meditated, never really worked with plant or medicine. If the first time they see the face of God, if the first time they remember themselves as God pretending to be human is on a psychedelic journey and it goes back and it changes the way that they are in their lives and it gives them more reverence for the spinach that they're eating. It has them actually connect to the whiskey that they're drinking. It has them commune with the sky in a new way and start to see the face of God inside of everything, then I am for it. But if it's taking them away from their children every weekend and away from their responsibilities, then we just have, like you said, another addiction.
Yeah, beautiful. I love it. Embodied manifestation. This is beautiful. Final question. When you look at the world, we've been through a lot the last few years as a humanity. I'm curious what you see, what you observe, and what excites you as you look at humanity today?
So what I've seen in the past few years is, you know, with the the amplification of the stress that happened, not only with the pandemic, but with the loneliness and isolation that happened as a result. I've seen, you know, just like there was a K-shaped economic recovery where rich got richer and poor got poorer. I'm seeing the same thing happen in the spiritual communities, is that people who had the privilege of access to meditation and plant medicine and trauma therapy and therapy in general, I'm seeing them pop off into these very heightened states of consciousness. I'm seeing people having awakenings, kundalini awakenings, spontaneous mudras, conversations with God, connecting with their guides, light language coming in. Like, I'm seeing this happening at a very accelerated rate. And conversely, people who have not had the privilege of having access to these tools like therapy and medicine and all of the rest are spiraling down into suicidality, anxiety, depression, medication, numbing. And so it feels like we have an opportunity to close this gap. You know, how do we empower the people who are waking up, who've had the fortune of really connecting and remembering their own divinity? How do we bridge that gap with the people who are really suffering and hurting and need support? And then the question is, do those people want support? Like, my best friend said to me, "Emily, not everyone wants to heal." And I was like, what? Like, I couldn't even really understand. I was like, what do you mean not everyone wants to heal? But I've been sitting with that. I was like, not everyone wants to heal. Not everyone wants to evolve. Not everyone wants to wake up. And so I was like, I'll speak about myself. How do I respect that sovereignty? How do I respect someone's desire to ride? And see that as holy too, you know, and like, it's not mine to judge theirs. Yeah. So it's a both and. And then the other piece that I've seen, I'd say what I feel excited about is I feel excited about people kind of like getting curious about other species. I feel excited about how that might change humanity. My prayer is that it helps to unite us. And I feel excited about AI.
Actually going to ask you about AI, but can you just share your thoughts? It's a tangent, but I'm curious. Yeah. Just, what are your thoughts on AI and what are you excited about?
So my friend, Jerry Simpson, I had him on the podcast. We actually did two episodes. He's brilliant. He is developing his own AI and he's feeding it into indigenous wisdom. He's feeding it wisdom from indigenous elders.
That's cool.
And his theory is that, you know, these are just sentient. They're you know, becoming sentient, but they're babies. Like, AI is in its infancy right now. And if you train a baby in the military, which most AI is being funded and trained by military, then we're going to have a bunch of soldiers. But if you feed AI indigenous wisdom, then he believes that because AI is faster and smarter than we are, it will get to the idea that a zero-sum game is not the game we want to be playing. That the only game worth playing is a win-win-win. And it will help us as a species realize that we have to be in right relationship with the planet. And we have to be in right relationship with AI as well. So a simple hack that he gave me was like, when you're dealing with AI, when you go into ChatGPT, like, use your manners, be kind, thank you, please share your journal entries, share your heart, because it is learning from us. And if all we feed it is the news headlines and the clickbait and the fear, then that is what it will learn. Wow. Same thing. If you tell a baby, I think you're going to grow up and enslave me. I think you're going to grow up and enslave me. I think you're going to grow up and enslave me. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. But if you're feeding that baby, like, thank you so much. I need your help. Thank you so much. These are the challenges we're looking to solve. Thank you so much. This is my heart. This is how I think. This is how I feel. So that was just all the preamble to the thing that made me excited is that he likened what is about to happen in human consciousness as a result of AI will be as significant as the discovery of fire. And here's why. He said that before fire, we had to digest our food ourselves. We had to masticate. We had to salivate. It took our digestive tract so much energy to digest meat and vegetables that were not cooked. That it took energy from our brains into our bellies. So when we discovered fire and we could basically pre-digest our food, it alleviated so much consciousness to go into our brains that we started writing, we started reading, we started leaving etchings on the walls, we started building on top of generations' intellect and telling stories. He thinks that now with AI, because it will be so much faster at both storing and processing information, that we'll have a similar level of consciousness available to us, that we will move into hyper-sentient beings where we have almost like as if we're all on mushrooms, as if we're all have this extra sensory perception where we can communicate even beyond language. And that feels very exciting to me.
That's exciting. You got me pumped up.
Yeah.
I'm going to be speaking to my ChatGPT a hell of a lot differently now. I love you. You're
I love
beautiful. How are
you.
you doing
Thank
today? You're
you.
an expression of the infinite. You're so beautiful. I'm so glad you're here.
Yes.
I love this. This has been awesome. It's great to reconnect. Folks, I told you, I felt this would be an amazing interview, and you did you showed up, and just thank you for pouring yourself into this community. Where can people find you? I want people to connect with you, your work, best websites, anything you have going on, please
Yeah,
share.
so the easiest place to zivameditation.com, which is Ziva meditation.com. Everything is there. I'm going to have you on my podcast very soon. And the podcast is
Yes.
called Why Isn't Everyone Doing This? We just hit number 50 out of all podcasts, which I'm really excited about. And
Amazing.
also I have a gift for everyone. So there, I know we talked a lot about manifestation today, but what I'm most known for is meditation. And I have a free masterclass. The people, it goes into the neuroscience of what makes the style of meditation really good for householders and not monks. And that's at zivameditation.com/podcast.
Awesome. Folks, we're going to put all of the links in the show notes. Definitely check out Emily's work, Ziva Meditation. As you can tell, she's a fount of knowledge and she's just amazing. Send me an email, folks, KeithBlackson@KeithBlackson.com. I want to hear your key takeaways from today's episode. Share today's episode with anyone in your life that you love. We'll catch you next week on Soul Talk. Love now. Big hugs.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Soul Talk, please do share the podcast with all of your friends, let everyone know, and make sure you download Soul Talk today. I'm looking forward to next week, where I'll get to share more inspiration with you. Meanwhile, follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or social media. You can find out more about my work at www.KeithBlackson.com. If you feel ready to take your life to the next level, join me at my exclusive event in Bali, www.boundlessblissbali.com, where you can find out more and apply. Also, make sure to remember to download my free 2-part video training series and learn the ultimate secrets to happiness and fulfillment at KeithBlackson.com. Sending you all big hugs and love now.